podcast this week, the only actor whose name is also a method of murder, Guy Pearce, drops by to talk about his new Netflix show, The Innocents. All that and usual movie news and nonsense on the movie podcast had finally won at HQ and is out of here. I am quitting. Fuck you guys. I want £8.13 and I am off to live at large on the Costa del Sol.
I have to point out, you use an extra life, so it doesn't count.
It absolutely counts. It's in my account. It counts.
Wow. Hello, so you're going to become a professional HQ player.
I am a professional HQ player. Right. Here's my plan. Do you know about HQ? For anyone who doesn't know about HQ, by the way, I should introduce myself very, very quickly before we do this. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. This week, I'm joined by three colleagues of such lethal cunning. We have our geek queen, Helen O'Hara.
Hey, up.
James Dyer is also here, which is nice, I guess. And we are joined, very rarely we are joined by someone who is an actual filmmaker and knows what he's talking about. And we'll find out then over the next hour or so. And we're delighted to be joined for the duration of the pod by the co-creator of The Inbetweeners, the director of the festival, which is in cinemas right now.
Yep,
still. Ian Morris. Still. It's still in cinemas.
Still in cinemas. Come on, guys. Come on, let's keep it there.
It opened on Friday.
Yep.
It's still in cinemas.
Yep.
We're doing well.
Doing well.
Good. How are you, sir? Are you all right?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm a little bit sweaty, but I'm very delighted to be here. It's a huge honour to be on the Empire Podcast. I thank you very much for having me.
To be clear, the sweat is due to actually working out and not, you know.
No, it's nerves. This is solid. I'm very, very nervous. Just one of those things. I feel like a bit like I'm doing a sort of tribute to Airplane at the moment. as I'm landing. So that'll get worse.
But the good thing to do is it's a very rainy day right now.
It is.
So it could be rain.
Could be rain.
It's not rain. It's just pure sweat.
Pure sweat, but yeah, so apologies. And also, hello.
Hello indeed. I'm also sweating, but you can't see it, which is a good thing.
Can you?
No.
Okay. Do you know what HQ is? Do you know what HQ is?
No, I'm going to guess it's a trivia app.
That's correct. It is a trivia app. Every day, there is a live quiz beamed around the world, and various hosts come on. They ask people 12 questions, and you can you answer these questions. And if you make it to the final answer and you get it right, you can split £1,000. Now, usually that means usually like 200 people win, but yesterday like only 300 people won, so I got a share of £1,000, £8.13.
Not bad.
Very excited.
They did a themed film one on 1:30 night, and everyone at Empire went out on the same question.
I didn't play that one.
You didn't play it because you were in a screening of The Equalizer 2.
Was I?
Yes, because I went to the early screening and I got out in time and you didn't.
Oh, that's right.
But the thing is,
what was the question?
It was a question about time out ranking of films. So it was like, which film did not appear in time? I'm like, that's not a film question, that's a time out question. And Phil isn't here, so I can't answer it. And I was very unhappy about the whole thing.
It kind of is a film question.
It's a timeout question.
Was it like number one though? Was it like which film was the number one?
No, there were two. There was one about which of the following films has a positive Rotten Tomatoes rating. And I was like, I don't know. And it wasn't Black Mass, apparently. Was Black Mass. Anyway.
But well done.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
Super well done. Yeah.
You should be doing your Beric at this point.
I don't think I should be doing my Beric at this point. I think that Ian...
Is it too niche?
Well, Ian is our guest in the podcast.
Well, I have no idea.
We don't think Ian needs
about.
To be exposed to your impression of Beric from HQ.
I'm not sure that I... Hello, HQers! Hello, Q1! And Christian Sauvage! No, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it.
Yeah. He reads Empire, though, so I think he'd probably enjoy it.
Yeah, he would.
Is he a bot?
He
feels there's this guy. So they rotate the hosts, but our favourite host is a guy called Beric Livingstone, who is actually giving them
Livingstone.
Beric Livingstone.
I mean, he's a bot. That's like a full on.
I don't know anyone who's encountered this person in real life.
That's like a bot. It's like,
if you
it's a
know,
name. It's like going, could you give me a stereotypical attempt at name from England and Scotland? I'll do Beric Livingstone. Fine. I presume.
Maybe we should ask, has anyone out there met him in real life?
Beric, I think you remember, wouldn't you?
You would.
You encountered
him in a jungle.
I don't think I've ever met a Beric.
No.
Beric Dondarrion. The Lightning Lord.
I've been through it on a train.
You don't watch Game of Thrones, do you, Ian?
I do watch Game of Thrones.
See, clearly you're not into the niche nitty-gritty nerdery
of
it.
Which one is he, though?
Beric Dondarrion, the undead Lightning Lord, who was raised by Thoros of Myr, the Red Priest. It doesn't matter.
No, I don't. Is he in the TV show?
Funnily enough, he has an incredible knowledge of Westerosi trivia. That's true.
Oh, okay.
That's wow.
So I love Game of Thrones.
Beric is an incredible man slash bot slash construct slash virtual construct, and his voice is incredible because he goes Cockney one second, then posh the next, like a bot trying to get the grips of the English,
like a sort of language learning machine that's trying to work out what language exactly sounds like. Like, maybe it's this, maybe it's this.
I figured out his voice is part Frank Spencer, part David Frost,
and. There's no way it's a living human being. How would you get through? I'm just saying, who would give that person a job? Who would be like, well, we found the perfect presenter. He sounds a bit like Frank. It's called Beric Livingstone. He's a bit like Frank Spencer.
And they have a thing on the HQ. So if loads of people go out of a question, they call it a savage question. And a big graphic comes up on screen and goes, savage question.
Yeah.
And Beric, being a construct, has changed that to, in question sauvage.
In question sauvage.
In question sauvage.
Again, I mean, because it's just, it's a bot, isn't it? It's a bot. Also, what I like is, well, he's not got much in his CV so far, but he'll be perfect for this, I think. Is he? Have you met him? Well, not met him, no, but he was very good on Skype.
But I was there when he was born.
He's currently living in Silicon Valley.
He will kill us all.
I very much enjoyed when his teleprompter broke at one point and he was forced to just wing it for about a good 30 seconds.
It was three minutes.
It was excruciating. Excruciating.
It's baffling. Is it a timed quiz every day?
Yeah, so it's live. So you get a notification on your phone. It's HQ time, and everyone logs in, a few hundred thousand people.
Right.
And then you get knocked out.
Pretty much that is my favourite thing in the world, is pub quizzes. Like, there was a solid period of my life where two or three times a week I was doing a pub quiz with some friends of mine. Same friends, normally. And it was really, like, it was a big part of my life. So, interesting.
Yeah. It's addictive.
Interesting.
Yeah. So Beric was basically talking a lot and buying time desperately, and that's not what I'm doing whatsoever.
Can you do a slight impression of him buying time? That'd be quite enjoying.
Time is created. It was back at the beginning of in the Big Bang. The Big Bang. There was a Big Bang. There was nothing. Nothing happened, and then there was time. Time is a great thing, isn't it? We all love time. It never stops. Never stops for anybody. I'm trying to find this week's question. It's not going well. Hang on a second. So it was a question about. I'll find the person who sent in the question imminently. But it was a question asking what we think the sexiest moment is in the Marvel Cinematic Universe to date. The question comes from Alex Boer.
The question comes from Helen L. O'Hara.
Hey!
And in fairness, it wasn't a question, but I liked it so much. So she tweeted into Helen going, just listen to the Ant-Man and the Wasp spoiler special, and I will be championing a spin-off podcast exploring the sexiest moment in the MCU. The definitive answer, of course, is Vision in a sweater. Now, we don't have...
like, that is pretty sexy.
A 70s sweater.
We don't have time to do a spin-off, but I thought we could talk, knock this around for a good 4 hours if you have time to do that. Ian, are you a big MCU fan? You a big Marvel fan?
No, I'm not. But I have... I've had two very close friends actually involved in two of the films, and so I have seen those two films, so I can at least... I can have a punt.
What two films have you seen?
I've seen Thor Ragnarok and Iron Man 3.
Those are good films.
Yeah, very good.
One of those is a very sexy film.
Yes, Ragnarok and pretty sexy, right? So I'm going to go for Chris Hemsworth when he has his top off. That's my favourite sexy bit.
I mean, that's a good guess, isn't
it? It's pretty good.
It is, however, the wrong answer.
Yeah,
the correct answer is when Captain America splits a log with his hands.
That is incorrect also.
Oh, no.
The correct
answer, I'm shivering just thinking about it,
is when Captain America told off Donald Trump for not reading. Just this week on Twitter. My God, I'm still recovering.
That's not technically part of the MCU.
It's non-canon.
I feel like it's pretty canon.
What about Cate Blanchett in Ragnarok?
When she first turns up, pretty sexy.
Yeah. She's pretty awesome in that film.
I love it when she goes sort of full Cockney, you know, when she's because
like
accent,
Beric,
just like Beric, depending on who she's talking to, her whole demeanor changes.
Hello,
like,
Asgardians. Kiwan.
Anyway, come in.
You've killed me. I can't do it now. Cate Blanchett in anything, really, isn't it? I love the fact also that Lord of the Rings was like 20 years ago, and she basically hasn't aged because she's an elf. She's immortal.
Yeah.
Well, one day she'll diminish and go into the West.
Yes, to the Undying
Lands.
Not
this day. I'm mixing quotes, I'm sorry.
It's fine. It's fine.
Yeah. I don't know. It is a Captain America moment, though, isn't it? It's Stephen Peggy in the car before he even gets big.
But it has to be...
I beg your pardon.
That's true.
Sorry. Well, so many poorly chosen words in that sentence. In what way does he get big? Sorry.
No, before that. Before he goes in and gets super...
All right, okay. So not the bit where, as James was talking about, where Steve Rogers grabs his wood and rips it.
Steve Rogers who? I'm sorry, I missed the end of that. Ah, yeah, that's it. The bit with the two of them in the car where, you know, the bit when he's... Yeah.
Talking about dancing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's not about dancing.
She is close to jumping on him right then. And he's not even Chris Evans yet.
He's a little fella.
Yeah.
All right, okay. Honestly, I don't think we get a lot. You know, like there's Cate Blanchett as Hela, but... You know,
I'm sorry,
you think about
there are so many butt shots of Black Widow. You cannot tell me you don't get
I'm not
anything.
A butt guy. I'm an asshole, but I'm not a butt guy. I think that I would have to go for, I don't know, Cap holding the helicopter. I mean, that's
pretty good.
That's a moment, isn't it?
That's pretty good.
You've seen that? And you should check it out. Captain America Civil War, there's a moment where Steve Rogers grabs, there's a helicopter and he's trying to stop the helicopter getting away and he grabs onto it and his biceps are glistening. Right. I'm doing this motion right now, which is really... Really weird. I don't know where it's coming from.
Imagine this.
Then get CG'd in afterwards.
Don't know what biceps are.
You've just been to the gym. You must have biceps.
Well, no, I haven't, sadly.
Do you have any seps?
What I've got is a sort of nascent alcoholism. So the gym is like trying to keep me at a sort of plateau. Just trying to plateau that one out. Don't get buff, but hopefully don't get too disgustingly dead in a ditch.
Because you're a writer, you're not meant to go to the gym.
No, but I did. I got into martial arts years ago, and it really helped my writing because I wasn't quite so angry the whole time. So I was like, this is much better. So since then, I've tried to sort of exercise a bit just to keep myself sane. I think
it does help with that. I think
it does. Yeah, it does.
Helen's a serial marathon runner.
Are you really? Mm. Good grief!
Very slowly, obviously.
No, but I mean, you run marathons; it's still pretty amazing. Yeah.
I don't know. I used to be impressed by marathon runners, and now I am one, so I'm not anymore.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
Because, yeah.
I can't.
All I do is start and not stop until I finish.
But I think that's sort of anything, isn't it? Really, anything is an achievement. Yeah. I started it. Lots of people couldn't do it. I didn't stop at it. I did it. That's what an achievement is, isn't it?
I suppose.
It's also pretty much how you run a marathon, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, it is, as it turns out. That's what I've learned. Yeah, you need kind of grit to get you through the first half, and then all it takes is bloody-mindedness after that. You're like, well, I'm not going home without a medal now.
I was about to say, it's the promise of the medal, Helen. It's really nothing else.
You do not run without a medal. That's
amazing.
That's rule one.
Yeah. I can't even do, like, a mile on a running machine. I've got very bad knees.
Mm. It's also really boring.
So boring.
It's so good.
Do you find you need team sports to keep you motivated?
I used to play a lot of football when I was younger.
Okay.
And then it got too violent, so I took up kickboxing. And that is the truth. I was like, there's too many fights in this Sunday league football. I think I'll do kickboxing.
Oh, you played Sunday league?
I played Saturday and Sunday league, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it was pretty rough.
So seeing people being sparked out and all that sort of stuff.
Just like, it got to the point, I was like, God, I can't go without a fight. That's another also, just like the energy going into it from people who weren't that good at football. I was like, good grief. It's exhausting. I was from the sidelines and the sort of things they'd shout. You'd be like, oh, my God. Yeah, and I'm a QPR supporter, so I've heard a lot of bad stuff being shouted. But, so I literally gave up and took up kickboxing, which I found less violent on a regular basis.
Okay, interesting. That's good. So, I would recommend a couple of MCU films for you if you've got some spare time on the flight home this week, because you now live in LA.
I do. My wife's American, yes. Although I've been here for 6 months.
Okay, all right. So,
backwards and forwards.
Yeah, of course. Jet setting.
It is, I suppose.
Racking up those air miles.
It is racking up, destroying the old planet. Take that, planet. I've got to make a comedy.
You're kickboxing the planet.
I'm kickboxing the planet.
Smack it in the face. Right.
Take that. Another one down. What's that, Greenland? Every time I fly over Greenland, I'm like, oh, no, that's another iceberg coming. That is me again. Oops. Whoopsie.
Is it true you punched a hole in the ozone layer?
I might as well be. The amount of times I've been flying backwards and forwards. I'm not proud of it, but it's, you know, I guess get through a lot of films.
I mean, there's no real alternative. You can't.
No,
walk, exactly.
The boat, I suppose, but even a boat's probably take a bit longer.
One does not simply walk into America.
It's a long way, LA. It's like a long way away. It's like much further than I sort of clocked, I think, when I met my wife out there. I'll just go back and forwards just to be fine.
Yeah, just hop around the M25.
Yeah.
Across the Atlantic. It's fine.
So far away, it turns out.
So you have been here. I should tell people how to get in touch with us on the podcast first before I start talking to you. We're professionals, Ian. You're in good hands here. So if you want to have your question treated with the respect it deserves, as indeed, what's her name? Alex Boer, found to her cost. You can get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast, or chances are we won't see it. Or just, no, Alex did. Or just tweet Helen and I'll see it as well. I don't know why I would see. I don't stalk your tweets.
Uh-huh.
I got blocked this week on Twitter. Well, maybe not this week, but I've been blocked on Twitter by Ken Jeong.
I heard that. I'm really? So sorry for your loss, I guess. Yeah.
I feel pretty bad about that.
What did you do?
It's fair.
I don't think I did anything. Well, I've never directly interacted with him. I went back and I checked in my review of Transformers 3 that I wrote that he does his tired old shtick. And I may have said it in the podcast once or twice that movie improves when he's thrown out of a window. But yeah. I still don't see how that brings him to my door.
So sensitive.
So sensitive. So weird.
So weird. I think probably, I mean, I don't understand the block button then. I'm a big muter. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Mute. See you later, mate.
Yeah. But do you forget? Sometimes you maybe mute someone just because they're tweeting a lot, but you actually quite like them. And then do you forget about that? Or do you go back and read?
Well, do you know what? Them? You've just reminded me. I did actually. The one I did was this is going to sound. Can I even say it? It sounds so bad. Yeah, go on then. I actually I muted Neville Southall. Because God, all right, mate. We get it. We get it. There's stuff happening in the world. All right, give us a break. So, so it does sound quite bad, I imagine, but I was just like, oh, good grief. Every night it's handed over to some people who need my attention. And I'm like, I'm trying to read about Queen's Park Rangers.
Neville Southall is a goalkeeper, James, former goalkeeper.
Right, and this is from the popular sport football.
Of the popular sport football.
He's a great goalkeeper. I loved him. Brilliant goalkeeper.
Yeah, played for Everton, or my bête noir. But
Queen's Park Rangers, that's a class in Dungeons & Dragons, isn't it?
Similar. That's correct, yes.
Like a half-elf ranger.
Yeah, that's correct.
Right, okay. Good.
So there you go. So you can tweet us, Empire Magazine, use the hashtag Empire Podcast, or chances are we won't see it. We're on Facebook as well as Empire Magazine, and you can email us also at podcast@empireonline.com. Right. It's time to interview Ian Morris.
Oh, crikey, okay.
Grill you.
Yep.
Mercilessly grill you. Because you've been going back and forth the last 6 months trying to finish the festival, which I believe you have. I've seen it.
It's funny. This morning I was thinking about this because it's been a weird old few weeks. And I think I genuinely finished it 2.5 weeks ago.
Really?
It was like, I remember the Thursday 3 weeks ago because I've been back to LA since. We had the premiere last week, I think it was. And the week before that, I was in LA, and the week before that, I was pulling my hair out, going insane, and things weren't right with the sound, and it was all sort of falling apart. So that's quite. So it's been a weird. And just because I feel very different, like once it's finished, it's out there. So there's not much I can do about it. Whereas at that point, it was a very, very, very stressful point in my life.
Yeah.
So 3 weeks ago, I think, under 3 weeks ago, I finished it. Yeah. Now it's in cinemas.
So what was that experience like? You know, because was there a point where you thought, oh Christ, I'm not going to make this date. They're going to show a half finished film, or
lots of points like that. Yeah.
Grab it away from me.
we have a brilliant post production supervisor and producer who does called Louise Seymour. He does lots of British films and stuff like Death of Stalin and things like that. And she's very, very good at making you make the film. And also, what she's pretty good at is putting in dates that she knows you're not going to hit, but making them sound like they are dates you've definitely got to hit, and you really believe that date.
Sounds a lot like our production editor.
Yeah, so this was the Thursday when I watched it back, and I was like, there's some issues here with the sound and stuff. And again, it's all decisions I've made. I just made the wrong decisions. And we were supposed to be watching it back just to go, tick, fine, film's done. But actually, we managed to get people to come back and work the next day until 3 a.m, and then work over the weekend, and then watch it back on a Saturday afternoon and stuff. So yeah, so it's having a really nice team of people that are willing to, you know, put up your foibles. But yeah, it's pretty. I'm just getting like a sort of bit of PTSD, like sort of a flashback. I've been quite enjoying myself the past couple of weeks instead of going back to it. But yeah, no, I was genuinely worried because we shot it last summer, so it's been living with the film for a long time. And then it still seems like a rush at the end, and you're like, oh God, that's annoying. I could have had plenty of time to do this.
Is that inevitable though? Like work expands to fill the time available?
Yeah, I think if you're disorganised, you can't really make a decision. And again, I think that's one of the hard things about comedy particularly is that you're looking at jokes and you're thinking, is that funny? I think it used to be funny. I've seen it 100 times. I'm not quite sure how funny it is anymore. I think it's funny. And you're like, oh, would it be funny if that happened? Or did I do, and then in one of the cuts, like 5 cuts back, I put that line in, which I've now taken out. Should I put that line back in again? So it's kind of like you're constantly driving yourself mad, or what I am constantly driving myself mad with that, really.
How much of comedy do you find works on set, and how much of it can you construct in the editing room? Like, where's the balance of finding the funny?
I think it's, I've always said this, and I'm not quite sure about it, but I think it's right, is that for me it feels like it's 3 distinct things. You get a script, and we do so many drafts of the scripts, and I worked so much on this script as well, that you try and make it the funniest thing you possibly do, and you do a read-through with the actors, like maybe a week before we start shooting, or rehearsals, and it's like, this is the funny, oh my God, that's perfect, that is as funny as it can get. And you get to rehearsals and you might tweak some lines, like, this is as funny as you can get. Then you get to shoot it, and then normally what happens is you get performances. I like a bit of rehearsal time, so you sort of know what you're going to get. But often things start falling apart around you, and you're like, oh, wait a minute. What is happening here? And it's kind of like, okay, just drive through this. Just drive through this bit, this sort of 8 weeks of your life. Try and get it all down. And then you get to the end and go, right, okay, well, that's not what we had in the script, but maybe we can make something out of this. And so it's always been sort of like, you know, three distinct things for me. It was very much the same. Even the first series, The Inbetweeners, was like what we had, what we'd written down, what we shot, and then what we got. And it was, and so having that experience, I guess, makes me think I don't panic too much on set about it. And I like people playing around, mm-hmm. particularly this film. Actually, there's much more improv and stuff on this film. But yeah, it's like it's sort of like three distinct processes, and then the edit becomes really the only one that matters, because you don't really get marks for trying, particularly in film. people tend to be quite focused on the end result.
Weird.
Yeah, I know, it's really annoying, because I'm like, guys, you know how difficult it was to shoot at festivals? It's like, massive lazy. All this, the scale and the budget was really low. Like, no one cares. Are we laughing or not?
When you're directing a comedy as well, is ADR your friend? Can you call people up and go,
for sure.
Jermaine Clement, for example, you go, I need you to say something now, and we'll drop it in on a shot where we don't see your face.
Yeah, there's lots of ADR. And again, actually, in The Inbetweeners, there's voiceover, and we used to write that when we were editing, even on the TV series. So we'd just be like, and actually, I mean, it was quite bad, because Caroline Liddy, who I was exec producer, was very demanding about the jokes, and she's brilliant, and, you know, and works in lots of comedies like Derry Girls at the moment, did Brass Eye and stuff. And so, in the last, you know, when trying to write that voiceover, I'd be sort of lying on the ground crying. I can't write any more sarcastic comments from Will. I can't do it. Don't make me do it. You know, and I literally used to do things like, I don't really read a lot of poetry, surprisingly, but I'd start reading poetry. I'd be like, well, I'm going to start reading poetry and I'm going to go to the theatre. Two things I never do. It's like my brain has to try and, I have to try and come up with something else to come in my brain to write this voiceover, you know?
Yeah. Oh my God.
That's why they're so poetic.
They're all in iambic pentameter.
They are, that's right, yeah. They're all like.
Is that where the turd down the water flume joke came from?
Pretty much. Yeah. No, that was
that's
we,
Milton, I believe.
We planned that. That took 4 days to shoot. 4 days of my life, that one. And yes, I am proud of it. But it was also, but actually, an interesting thing about that was, so we had these 4 days to shoot it in this water park in Australia. It was so complicated. And also, it's so time consuming, because we had to be like, put the camera in this angle, shoot the slide, shoot the bottom of the slide, shoot Will coming out of the slide, shoot Will with the shit on his face, shoot Will without the shit on his face, shoot with Will with the puke rig. And the production meeting with me, Damon, the first AD and the DOP, Ben Wheeler, took 6 hours to plan where they're going to go, right? That was one day one, right? And I remember going to bed and just thinking, it wasn't that funny. We didn't really get that today. Like, those camera positions aren't the right place. They're not in the right place. And we had this whole thing planned for the next day, and it was so important. And then I'd been to see, just before we went to Australia, I'd been to see Nosferatu at the BFI. And I was like, it's the humanity of the monster. It's the humanity of the monster. And I came in the next morning, and I was like, we started shooting at 4:30 in the morning. I was like, it's the humanity of the monster. It's the humanity. We've got to, let's tear this shot list up. We've got to get in the pool with Will. We've got to be in his face. We've got to be running around like this. And everyone was like, well, we're not going to get to shot. I was like, I don't care. It's the humanity of the monster. And then literally we couldn't get back to the location we'd been at the day before, and I was like, right, I'm going to go and shoot it on my iPhone. And the cameraman was like, I think I can probably get there with the camera. And it's like, actually, in that shot, it's like me and the first AD running across camera and then running across camera again to get the close-up, because we didn't have time to get the sporting artist over there. We weren't supposed to be shooting there. It was like 9:00. So yeah, you're kind of like, sometimes you are sort of, whoop, okay, off we go. Yes, inspired by Nosferatu, not poetry.
You heard it here first.
There you go.
So in this movie, you team up again with Joe Thomas.
Yeah.
But this isn't, I think people were going, is this an Inbetweeners spin-off? But it is not. It's a different character, different thing.
Yeah.
But you also explored the humanity of the monster in this film with Joe Thomas, because I went into this film going, I don't think I've ever seen Joe Thomas's naked arse.
Yeah,
and that is cured now. I've seen it many, many times. Yeah. Did you know that was your comedy secret weapon? And was he okay with bearing all?
We've got a bit of a joke, me and Joe. I say joke. I see. I've got a joke, and Joe repeats it, which is that I've now seen basically on screen. We've now managed to show everything apart from his actual helmet and his right testicle.
Yeah, yeah. The left one got an airing. I remember that.
Yeah, the lefty. Lefty's been out, but all lefty. But. That was a pretty good scene to shoot.
Dr. Kenneth Noisewater.
But he basically, there's a lot of Joe in it, certainly. There's actually one shot, we did a big screening, and there was one close-up when he gets the tattoo, and we were like, I've got to take that out. We haven't seen that on the big screen. I was like, that is too much of Joe's bum. And it was funny because Joe had never met Nick Frost before, and there's the scene where Joe's bums out and Nick and Claudia are there. And it was Joe's like, oh, it's like my comedy hero is behind me just staring. And then Claudia at one point said, Joe said, oh, just I can feel the breath on my sphincter now. And Claudia said, I think I can see your lungs. So it's gone. And Hamid, who plays Nick's best friend, Joe's best friend in the film, was a huge fan of The Inbetweeners, and him and his brothers went to see it at the cinema and stuff. And I could see that was the day the kind of scales fell from his eyes. Because yeah, like the first week, I could see him thinking, here's my hero, oh my God, I can't believe I'm making a film with Joe Thomas. Here's the third hour starting with me, staring right up his brown eye. So, yeah, it was pretty... But yes, it wasn't really... I mean, you know, let's think of Joe as a muse, if you like.
OK. All right, yeah.
It's like my Greta Gerwig. some ways.
It is extraordinary. I was taken by the use of shadow in that scene.
Yeah,
I'm grateful for it.
Yeah, no, there had to be a bit of touch up on that. It was a bad one. It was a bad one for the digital colourist, yeah, Rob.
I was like, no, I think we pointed that down a bit, don't we, Rob? He was like, let me just zoom in. I was like, whoa, wait, okay, here we are.
So there are victims sometimes in filmmaking.
Indeed.
Thoughts and prayers.
You mentioned that you shot this at a festival. Festivals or just one festival? Or
two festivals. We shot at Leeds Festival. Leeds very kindly gave us permission to shoot, and we shot some big crowd scenes there. And we shot at Bestival for a few days before it was open and when it was open as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then we built a kind of set just near, not far from Glastonbury, south of Bristol, about near Chew Lake, so Chew Magna Lake, I think it's called, about half an hour south of Bristol, because I wanted to get that sense that you get when you're at Glastonbury, where the horizon is kind of hills, so you're always looking. So basically the idea is that even the single shots are kind of, there's a green line around it, making you feel like you're in a big bowl at Glastonbury. But actually, again, it was one of those weird things where we're like, we're going to build a set, and then we're like, oh, good, because the shooting of the festival was really, really difficult and really horrible, because it's almost the exact opposite of a film set, which is it's incredibly noisy and nobody knows where they're going or what they're doing, whereas a film set is silent and everyone pretty much knows what they're doing.
Yeah.
And so when we were back at the set, we're like, oh, it's great, we're back at the set. But actually, a festival set is just simply a field, and last summer was quite rainy, and Glastonbury gets muddy after 5 days. We were there for 7 weeks.
Oh my
God. It was an absolute nightmare. And you'd be like, oh, don't worry, we're filming the set today, and that just means we're outside. Then we had this storm, and half the tents blew away, and it was mixed summer for me last year. You know, up and down.
I mean, there are moments in this film that just make me think, I've never been to a festival. I just think, what Nick experiences, especially in the first half of the movie, there's an awakening. I don't want to spoil anything, but there's an awakening for him as the movie goes on. But the first half of that film is exactly what I would be like at a festival. I would be miserable.
Yeah.
I'd be the wallflower. I'd be in the standing there while everyone's having fun, going, I just want to go home.
Yeah, I think that was the idea, really. I kind of wanted it to be like... There's not, you know, it's not all fun and games at festivals. It can be quite boring. And particularly if you're not that sort of person. I wasn't. And now I'm sort of a bit converted to festivals.
Okay.
From going to quite a few for research purposes, it was good.
Stockholm Syndrome.
Yeah, it got me. Do you know what? I've never owned a pair of wellies before, but after the age of like 5, and I've suddenly got obsessed with my Hunter wellies. I was like, I should become a farmer.
They're really good.
They're like, so comfortable.
So good. Oh, I went to Glastonbury a couple of years ago, though, and it rained, obviously.
Yeah.
And I was like, hey, wellies are amazing.
Absolutely amazing, aren't they?
I was on set of Predator and it was absolutely freezing, and they lent me a pair from the props department, and I tried very hard to steal them.
Yeah.
And the unit publicist came and found me just before my flight and asked for them back.
That's good.
I was really upset. They were interlined and everything.
They're just like, because I wore them for the premiere, because the idea of the premiere was like festival chic. And everyone was like, that's funny, you're wearing your wellies. I was like, yes, it's funny. Ha ha. I'm not wearing them because they're insanely comfortable. No, it's funny, isn't it? Ha 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 ha. The wellies I'm wearing. But yeah, so basically, get a pair of wellies. You love a festival.
Yeah. What have you got against Crowded House?
I love Crowded House.
Okay.
I love them. I genuinely love them. Like, I was so obsessed with Crowded House that I applied successfully to be an exchange student when I was 15 and went to Australia because I thought that was closer to New Zealand, so I had more of a chance of seeing Crowded House. I was in the Crowded House fan club from like 13 to 15. So there's a weird thing about that, the sort of joke in the film where Jermaine's singing Crowded House was like, I know I picked this music, but I don't know what the joke is. I think she's watching it going, both these songs are really good. Yeah. What's funny about this? And everyone's like, oh, so I love that bit. I'm like, I don't know what the joke is. I mean, I think I've done it as a joke. The joke I don't think it's funny.
The joke is Jermaine Clement singing Crowded House.
That's it.
And then it works. Yeah. So it's all good. Yeah. But I was you know, because Robin is in the film, he's not... He's a well-meaning guy, but he's a figure
he's
of fun
cool,
in the film.
Yeah.
He's not cool, and so by definition and by extension... Therefore, Crowded House, one of the greatest bands of all time.
Yeah. I agree.
Also not cool.
Do you want to hear my... I've got Crowded House story. It's quite a bit name-droppy. Do you want to hear it?
Do it.
Of course. Yeah.
So I must have been doing the publicity for the second in between this film, and I was passing through Auckland for like 3 or 4 days. And I've got quite a lot of Kiwi friends from the Concords and stuff like that. And a friend of mine, Madeline Sami, just made a very good film called Breaker Uppers, which I would recommend to everybody. It's really funny. She said she knows I'm a huge Crowded House fan. She said, well, her wife were staying with Neil Finn and Sharon Finn. And they said, why don't you come visit? I said, I can't, because I'm such a big fan. It's going to look super weird. And I'll just be totally weird, like I was when I met Simon Le Bon. I can't do it. And she was like, okay, cool. And then she disappeared, and she came back and went, oh, I've called them. They're expecting us in 20 minutes. And I was like, oh, man, okay. All right, but play it cool, Morris, play it cool.
So sweating already.
I was really sorry. I went round to Neil Finn and Sharon Finn's house, and it was... He opened a bottle of red wine, gave me a tour. There was some of the original artwork from some of the albums on the walls and stuff, and from the Finn brothers. I was like, this is the greatest day of my... This is absolutely amazing. And my friend Carthy, who I was with, was like, we've got to go and see... What we do in the shadows, we're going to go and see the... I was like, I've seen it. He's like, no, we said we'd go, and I was like, oh, God. So we had to leave. But I was like, oh. And Neil Finn couldn't have been more lovely and brilliant and everything you'd ever want when you meet someone here is. Anyway, the next day, Brett McKenzie was flying in to Auckland, and we were going to spend a day together. And he flew in, and he said, got a bit of a special treat for you. And I said, what is it? I phoned Neil Finn and said, you guys are like, oh, that's going to be super weird, isn't it? So it's just like, oh, it's me again. So I thought, like, come on, what have you done? He went, oh, yeah, I thought you'd like to go and meet Neil Finn. So I phoned him up. So I was like, no, we can't get it. Can't do that.
This just reinforces my notion that everybody in New Zealand knows each other.
Yeah, pretty much do.
Yeah, they do.
And they just have Neil Finn's number on speed dial.
Yeah, it was pretty good, though. I was like, oh, that's, can I? I was tempted to go back, but instead we went... Some vineyard somewhere. Me and Brett.
We're Sam Neill's vineyard. We're sitting.
Yeah. I was like, Sam Neill.
He was just hanging out there with Peter Jackson.
Yeah, I'll be like, come back tomorrow. but yeah, that's my Crowded House story.
Oh wow! I waited outside the BBC once to speak to Neil Finn after he was on an episode of Later with Jules Holland.
Oh yeah.
But I'm just awful at meeting my heroes.
Yeah.
Film heroes, fine. But football heroes and music heroes, I just go to pieces. And my small talk is bad at the best of times, but when you're faced with someone that you genuinely revere, it's just, I come across as some sort of psychotic stalker. I should have killed him just to follow through on it, because I'm sure he thought I was just a nut job.
Yeah, he probably would have preferred to be killed by it.
Yeah, he would have gone, well, this is playing now how I expected it to be.
I trust my instincts.
Yes, that's right.
There's a feeling of slight relief here as I'm being stabbed.
I was at a party once where Simon Le Bon was, and I'm a huge Duran Duran fan. I was so excited to see Simon Le Bon, and I got more and more drunk. My wife's like, just go and say hello and you like his music and then come away. I was like, yeah, I'm going to do that. Yeah, I'll do that. Yeah, I'll do that. Yeah, I'll do that. Probably do that. Yeah, I'll do that. Anyway, so I walked over to Simon Le Bon. I basically stood next to him, like shoulder to shoulder, not even facing him. I went, hello. He went, hello. I went, favourite Duran Duran song? Yeah. And he went, Ordinary World. And I went, number two. And he went, The Chauffeur. And I said, thank you, goodbye. My wife was just, I was married, so it wasn't that long ago. My wife was just shaking her head. Like, Jesus Christ.
That is extraordinary. And thank you also, because I'm a big fan of natural segues, Ian. And Simon Le Bon, of course, once sang a Bond theme tune.
The best one.
Boom. No,
look
it's
at
not.
That segue.
No, it's not.
Yes,
no,
it is.
It's not.
Die another day, clearly.
No, come on. I love Chris Cornell's.
He's good. I like Chris Cornell's as well. It's Goldfinger,
isn't it?
Like... Goldfinger? Is it not Goldfinger?
No. Look at Ian's face.
He's not entertaining this at all.
No. I know the answer. The answer is Neutrakill.
That's it, and we're done.
Which brings us neatly onto the news this week. Look at that. Look how I did that. That Danny Boyle... This is pretty much the only news we'll be discussing, I think. That Danny Boyle has left Bond 25.
Yes.
The seat is vacant. There's a director's chair with a name yet to be stitched on it. Ian Morris.
Well, I'll throw my hat in the ring, if that's what you're asking.
That's what I'm asking.
It would be an absolutely amazing decision from him, I think. I mean, you have to sort of know your place slightly.
Yeah.
But no, I'd do it, yeah, sure. I mean, the truth is, before Christmas, when I was doing a lot of editing for this film, you know, it's hard to watch things sometimes. You're like, oh, God, I don't want to be too influenced by things, but also you don't want to, you know, you'll get too stressed by what you're doing, what other people are doing and stuff. So I was watching 3 or 4 times each, and this does sound a bit like an Alan Partridge driving to Aberdeen eating Toblerone, but I watched every Roger Moore Bond. They were about the only things I could take on board. And I was like, oh, you're watching, you know, Breaking Bad and stuff like that. Success. I was like, no, I'm watching Moonraker again. So if I was doing it, I would bring that style right back. That's my Bond era.
That's where they should go.
I found the one that was the biggest, most successful film of all time. This is why I'm not getting the job. So boring. I was like, oh, God, he's sad Bond. And he's... Mum's got killed, he's got one gun, crying in a house in Scotland. I was like, Jesus, wept. Me and my friends literally watched. We went to see that, then we watched View to Kill straight after. It was like a palate cleanser. Yeah, we're back. Christopher Walken chewing the scenery. I would love to do it, and I'd put him in flares, and I'd have a NASA scientist called Holly Goodhead, who introduces herself with the words, "Hello, I'm Dr. Holly Goodhead from NASA... the space agency." Just absolutely, in case James Bond didn't know who NASA were.
It's not nuclear physicist Dr. Christmas Jones, yeah, but no, I guess yeah, it's yeah, pretty it's good.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a good one in View to Kill where some beautiful woman introduces himself to the stables, and he says, she says, and it's just like a name, it's not even that good a name, it's like, not even like, not Pussy Galore, and it's like, I'm Elizabeth Bennet. And he goes, "Of course you are, my dear." I'm like, that doesn't work. There's nothing, is it? Yes, she is.
There's no innuendo there at all.
Of course you are, my dear. I mean, who's going to be then?
I don't know.
If not me, then who?
If not Ian Morris, who has put himself right at the top of the list.
Number one on the list. But yeah. Who's number two? I mean, look, they're not... I think, you know, their fanboys are all getting excited because, like, Christopher Nolan, for example, hasn't announced his next film. That's not going to happen. They just had a big name director, yeah, a sort of, you know, name above the title director, and creative differences reared their head. They're not going to risk that happening again. It's not going to be.
It's fine. It's all going to be fine. I'm very interested to see what Ron Howard is going to do with the film. It's going to be fine.
I even think he's too big a name for them.
You think?
I think.
They'd sign Mendes.
They did.
That's a strange way to pronounce it, isn't it?
Mendes.
I don't know. I think the bookie's favourite at the moment is Yann Demange. So yes. I feel like that's a more realistic probability.
There is a feeling that Eon Productions, who are in charge of the Bond Crown Jewels, like to have directors who are pliable. Mm. So the second unit is tasked with the big action sequences and whatnot, and then the director comes in and goes, okay, now raise your eyebrow 37 degrees, thank you very much. But I don't know, this honestly, I'm not surprised that Danny Boyle has walked. I don't think he's a natural fit for blockbusters. He's tried in this arena before with what became Alien Resurrection, and that didn't really work out for him, and since then he's just ploughed his own furrow, and I think he's too idiosyncratic as a filmmaker to really, you know, play in this sort of sandpit. So it didn't come as a huge surprise. I would have liked to see what he was going to do with it. Mm. I think there's a natural tendency online to presume that means you're just going to do the same old, that Purvis and Wade may rear their heads again as writers. Who knows? I don't know necessarily that they're going to do that. My feeling in this is that Daniel Craig knows how disappointed people were by Spectre, and he wants to go out on a high, an all-time high.
Yes.
And if that means getting Ian Morris in the director's chair and Duran Duran to do the song again...
So be it. That's what it's going to take.
But lots of people are, you know, obviously throwing Chris Nolan's hat in the ring and Chris McQuarrie's hat in the ring. I think Chris McQuarrie's just made the best Bond film in years.
Yeah, exactly.
In Mission Impossible Fallout. I look forward to a 10-hour podcast about Bond, but I don't think that he would do it. He'll sign on tomorrow now. The minute this podcast comes out. Chris McQuarrie to direct Bond 25. But I don't know. A lot of people throwing Catherine Bigelow's hat into the ring as well. There's a lot of wish fulfillment, I think. Yeah. A lot of people would like to see a Catherine Bigelow Bond.
I think it'd be interesting because I think she's really good at deconstructing masculinity in that way. And I think and she's a great action director. But again, I think she's busy doing her own thing. I don't think she has any wish to do a big studio movie right now. So I'd be amazed. I think it's going to be somebody who has made some well-received smaller films, I don't know, like the festival, and then just, you know, just go from there.
Oh, I'd love it. I absolutely love it. Oh, it'd be brilliant, wouldn't it?
What if they said you can direct Bond, but it's going to be a 20-week shoot in a field?
Done. Done. I'd do it properly. I'd like a pretty easy apple. I was sitting on a box, literally a box for 7 weeks, and they got a bit weird about that. They're like, oh, he wants his box again. I was like, I'm sitting on a fucking box. I'm not even asking for a chair. Oh, here's your box. They signed it and gave it to me as a gift. And then they're like, here's your box. I'm like, you're sitting on a box. A box.
It wasn't a throne.
It wasn't like a director's chair. A box in a muddy field, covered in mud.
Did it have your name on it?
It eventually did. So they're like, oh, where's this box gone? It's like, well, someone left it out in the rain last night. It's absolutely soaking wet. Freezing cold box. I've been sitting there. Oh, wants his box dry, does he?
It's this kind of diva behaviour that really qualifies you for this job.
I wasn't she like, am I being a bit much? I just some dry box to sit for 10 hours? Is this weird? Am I being a bit much? I know it's a low budget film, but come on, guys. A box. They said, we're going to make you a box because you've been borrowing the box off the grips department. So we're going to make your own box. I was like, okay, thank you. And then they came back and they went, I said, did they make that box? I don't want to, you know, borrow the Crips box. And they said, we've made it, but there's a bit of a mistake, actually. We made it 4 feet by 4 feet, like a coffin. They're like, yeah, we made you a coffin. So I was like, okay, everything is so weird. I just want something to sit on. A chair, maybe? No. And eventually I got my own box with my name on it.
Amazing. Where's that box now?
It's literally in my house because I had to take it for the reshoots and everything. I was like, I'm not going to lose this box. I fought so hard for a box to sit on. So, yeah, so would I do Bond? Yeah, I'd probably do Bond, I thought. Yeah. I'd probably step up because yeah. It's a slightly higher budget. Might be. I did a lot of research recently for this film that I didn't get about Russ Meyer. And there was a big thing about when he did his Beyond the Valley of the Dolls film. And quite a lot of it, the theory of it was that he was just like, he was constantly lugging gear the whole time. And it was like, he was making so much money from these films because his films would run for like 2 or 3 years in cinemas. And they were so low budget, you know, like Faster Pussycat, Kill Kill and stuff. And then they were like, why do you go and do a studio picture? Why do you do a studio picture? And he, in one interview, literally said, I'm really bored of carrying cameras around. Just really want to do something where somebody else carries the camera.
Yeah, I want a box with a cushion.
Yeah, exactly, with a cushion, yeah.
One of those boxes with cushions on it, but it has legs. What do you call them? Chairs. That's it. That's it. One.
It was quite funny because they said to me, they said, they're like, we've got your chair. I was like, oh, great. Saturday. It's like, Rick! 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 I said, okay, well, I can't use that, can I? Because it's going to be quiet the whole time. I have to be quiet with a chair. I said, okay, we'll get rid of it. Gone. Nothing for the rest of the week. Box. That is filmmaking for you. That is very glamorous.
Thank you for pulling back the curtain.
I know, yeah.
Oh, no, there's no curtain.
It's these little things. No curtains on this film.
Would Joe Thomas be your Bond baddie?
Jay's a really good actor, I think, and I would cast him in pretty much anything. So, yeah, I'd cast him as my Bond baddie. I'd probably cast Buckley as a Bond baddie. I think James Buckley would be a good Bond. Well, he did want to play Bond himself, so maybe I just cast him as Bond. And we used to have a joke.
That would be interesting, yeah.
Yeah, we used to have a very unfair joke for James Buckley, which is that he wasn't great at remembering his lines. And when he told us he wanted to be Bond, the running joke was basically like, the name's Bond. Was it? I've got these sides. James Bond. He'll kill me for that, but I love him.
I look forward to that. We got one last thing. Genuinely, there's no other news this week. I've been trawling through a movie website, obviously not Barnline.com, to find the news. And there's pretty much nothing, apart from the fact that Damon Lindelof's Watchmen has been given a green light at HBO, yeah. Which is exciting.
And John Hamm and Ed Harris are on in the new Top Gun film.
Oh, that's nice. That's good for them. Well done.
Although in our story on the website, we refer to Tom Cruise as Peter Mitchell, Maverick. That's very formal. It's very formal.
I never knew he was called that.
He's definitely Pete
Maverick
to me.
Mitchell. And he's Pete, yeah.
But it's Peter in our new story. Peter Maverick. Peter.
Who wrote that?
No, well, I assume it was James White.
You're the site editor. You're supposed to sell this.
If he doesn't feel comfortable referring to Maverick as Pete, then who am I to tell him he needs to be informal?
You're the site editor. I just told you.
Okay.
Peter Mitchell. It's not like Mitchell. I'm his boss.
Commander Peter Mitchell.
I thought the Watchman actually is... If you're going to think of what's the least sexy scene... Because I was such a huge Watchmen fan, I was at the IMAX for the day. The least sexy scene in any DC Universe film.
Yeah.
The opposite of what you were talking about earlier. I'd say the Hallelujah sex scene in the thing is pretty bad. It was like a lot of people in that cinema going, chairs going again, people hiding a bit like, well, this is pretty eggy, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd say that's probably fair. Although I like that film.
I love it. I love it.
Yeah. But that's a perhaps misjudged moment. But
yeah.
But hey-ho. Any other bits of movie news before we move on?
Lena Dunham and Maya Hawke joining Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
I mean, that's,
you know, that's a thing that's happened.
Lego's releasing a Cloud City set. There you go.
That's cool. That's fun. Wait, how are you going to balance that?
It's hard to say. There's a small picture, but it seems to be a close-up of the carbon freezing chamber.
Oh, okay.
Mm. Oh, that's exciting. All right, so that's probably it for movie news.
And they're making a Crazy Rich Asians sequel. Yes. Having read the second book, I think this could be a lot of fun.
Crazier Richer Asians.
Which did very well in the box office.
It's called, I've forgotten, but it's a very good, it's fun.
So Rob Thomas said Veronica Mars is coming back, which is very exciting. No,
all right.
You're not a marshmallow.
Never seen it. Sorry, not a, no, not a marshmallow.
Marshmallow.
Yes, that's what they're called. Yeah, big fan of Veronica.
I didn't come here to be insulted.
You're no marshmallow. Get out, sir.
There were some good trailers this week. So I do recommend, if you haven't seen it already, the trailer for Slice, which is of course a pizza vampire werewolf Hellgate movie. We've all seen those before. And Jeremy Saulnier's new film.
I did not want to see the trailer for that.
Do not see the trailer for that. I haven't slept since.
No,
it's scary.
I want to see the film. Jeremy Saulnier, director of Blue Ruin and Green Room. I think he's an incredible director, and I know this movie's going to be gruesome and grisly, and I don't want anything to be given away. I'm taking a leaf out of Emma Thrower's old book and not watching the trailer for that one.
And there's also a trailer for Outlaw King, which is the Robert the Bruce
yes.
film with Chris Pine.
Let's go for that.
Which seemed to go over rather well. And his Scottish accent sounded okay to me.
You are obviously the best judge of this. So,
well, I'm not that. I'm
Celtic.
I mean, people mistake my accent for Scottish. So, pretty much, yeah, they do.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's happened to me as well. Norwegian.
You do sound quite Norwegian.
I do sound quite Norwegian,
especially when you're doing Beric.
Hello, HQers. Right, it is time now for this week's guest. Very, very exciting. The other week, the other guest. Right. Ian is part of the team.
Oh, no.
Ian is part of the team. Are you relieved we haven't asked you about whether In Betweeners is coming back? Because I'm sure you get that a lot. In Betweeners coming back?
That's normally number one. I don't know, really. Probably not. I wouldn't have thought so. I mean, not tomorrow. I mean, that's the thing. People ask me that. Is In Betweeners ever coming back? I'm like, I don't know. Can't tell the future. But I mean, we all get on really well. We all like working together. Me and David haven't got an idea. I mentioned this actually. I was interviewed on TalkSport and I said, well, you know, the only thing is we haven't really got any ideas. Ha 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 ha. And then I had like, I think 400 people tweet me the word stag do. I was like, yes, we've thought about a stag do. The point is you have to have more than just the word stag do. And you have to have a little bit more, we put a bit more into it than that. But thanks so much.
You need about a box and everything.
The in-betweeners.
Yes.
Colon.
Yeah.
The humanity of the monster.
Well, I've done that. See, killed that last time.
That is true. That
killed
is true.
It.
The turd's revenge.
The turd's revenge.
But then again, the turd got revenge last time. Anyway.
Sorry, Guy Pearce.
Guy Pearce. So he has a new Netflix show out. It's called The Innocents. It is out today, Friday the 24th of August. It's a supernatural love story, and he plays a mysterious scientist at the heart of this shape-shifting drama. We love Guy Pearce. He's amazing. He was in L.A. Confidential, Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, Neighbours and Home and Away. Didn't ask him about that, but I spoke to him in London this week and we had quite a serious conversation, actually, so we might need a bit of a tonal reset after this nonsense.
Last time he was on this podcast, he was talking about jailbreaks in space, so it makes a nice change.
Oh, was he now? Yeah. Okay, this was actually quite serious and about identity and accents and all that sort of stuff. I was completely lost, to be honest, and so here I am trying desperately to hang on to Guy Pearce's coattails. Do please enjoy. Delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the star of Netflix's The Innocents, Guy Pearce. How are you, sir?
Very good.
Good. Unjet-lagged.
Unjet-lagged, yes, that's right.
That must be a wonderful feeling.
Well, since having a baby, I think I've spent probably every day for the past 2 years feeling jet-lagged. You're just sort of, you know, dealing with a lack of sleep. But although my little boy sleeps better now than he did when he was 3 months old.
Oh, that's good. So you're out the other side.
A little bit.
You're into unjet-lagged, Phil.
That's right.
Excellent. Yeah. That's good to hear. When The Innocents lands on your desk, what's your first reaction? Do you think, is this a remake of that classic British horror film, or are you intrigued?
No, I wasn't aware of the classic British horror film.
You should check it out. It's really good.
To me, it was just an original idea that took my fancy as soon as I read it. And I had a great chat with Farron Blackburn, our director, who... Mm-hmm. Who sort of impressed upon me the idea that, you know, this was to be treated as a very real condition, these women who are afflicted by this genetic malfunction where they essentially, I suppose, as a kind of a survival technique, shift into the person that they're close to at any given moment, depending on what their trigger might be, whether it's stress or a horrific situation or whether it's love for another character, you know. So it's a condition that these women have no control over. Obviously, highly unusual. You know, we don't really see this happen in life, but Farron...
Or do we?
That's right. Who are you? But Farron, our director, as I say, wanted to make it very clear that the style of the show and the tone of it was to not necessarily sit in science fiction world, you know, that it should sit in the realm of reality, that this should be treated like a feasible medical condition. Mm-hmm. So, you know, after having a great chat with him, I was definitely on board. I mean, I was interested and on board anyway, but it wasn't like he had to convince me of anything. So, just very well written and really interesting character that I get to play. So.
Indeed. I mean, we'll get on to it in a second, but people binge watch Netflix shows.
People do, but I don't think Netflix like the term binge.
They don't.
When we did the promotion for this in the States, we were strictly sort of instructed beforehand not to talk about binge watching. So, but now I've made an issue out of it. So.
Well, what's the terminology that they recommend?
I'm not sure.
Marathon watch?
I guess so. Yeah, just yeah.
Elongated entertainment. What exactly?
I don't know. You'd have to ask them. Netflix a call.
I'll get on them right away. I'll get on to Ted Sarandos right away. But do you binge read the script? I presume you get all 8 episodes at the same time.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, I'm a real slow reader, so it might have taken me more than just 8 hours to read the whole thing. And of course, at the time, my little boy was quite young, so finding 8 hours,
you were in jet lagged, Phil.
Free 8 hours is impossible with a small baby. In fact, how old was he when I think this was the beginning of last year, so I guess he was, you know, 6 or 8 months old, something like that.
Okay.
So I was probably stealing an hour or two here, there and everywhere, but managed to cobble together enough to know that I wanted to do it.
Did the character grab you right away?
Yeah, absolutely. I was a little mystified in the same way that we as an audience probably will be mystified by him when we watch the show, because... Yeah. Primarily, we're following this young couple of Harry and June escaping their lives and running off together, as is the wont of young lovers. And so we obviously keep cutting back to this unusual solitary environment on an island in remote Norway, where we see this doctor and his partner, this Norwegian woman called Runa, and another couple of women there who are also afflicted with this condition. And we get the sense that this doctor is sort of not experimenting with them, but he's trying to analyze them and understand what's going on for them and trying to understand how to help them, etc. So we sort of keep going back to them occasionally amongst the scenes between young Harry and young June. So you know it is mysterious, this world on this island where this a mythical place called Sanctum exists. Yeah. I shouldn't say mythical, that makes it sound like Game of Thrones. So I was, you know, I was intrigued to sort of keep reading and find out where that all leads. And obviously we learn that the character of Elena, who's on the island with us there, is the mother of June.
Yeah.
And so there's a real connection and a real sort of desire to get June out to the island to try and help her as well. So I was very intrigued by my character of Dr. Halvorsen.
And the interesting thing about him is, I mean, people will be watching this now. This interview is out the same day as the show was out. So people may have already elongated, entertainmented the show in its entirety. Who knows? But just in case, we won't go into spoilers. But let's just say that there is he or isn't he about your character in terms of his intentions and whether his intentions are good or his intentions are bad. I wonder what that's like for you as an actor going into you're reading a whole bunch of scripts, and obviously you have to play scenes before certain revelations with the knowledge of your character and his intentions in your mind. So how do you go about it? Is it something that you have in your head the whole time?
Well, essentially, I mean, I'm always looking at it from the inside rather than from the outside. Okay. You know, so obviously we always, whenever we do these publicity things and we talk about and we promote a show, it's always from the point of view of the viewer. It's mm-hmm. always from the point of view of analyzing it from the outside. Mm-hmm. Whereas everything that I do is from the inside. Mm-hmm. You know, everything is about the motivation of this character, the drive of this character, what the makeup is of that character. Obviously, I'm aware that it's going to be seen in a particular order or mm-hmm. that it's going to be perhaps perceived in a particular way early on, and do we want to give so much away? But any of that sort of stuff to me is answered by the truth of the character and by the sort of complexity and the understanding that I have of that character. If things feel amiss or they feel awry or you feel like you're conveniently leaving something out in order to just have some sort of surprise element later or some kind of twist, then I've got to address that. You know, I can't do things that just feel sort of convenient for the sake of the viewer.
Of course.
You know, so it's always about finding a good balance, I think, and just getting to the heart of it. And if, you know, and I think, you know, not necessarily just talking about this character, but any character who we're mystified by, you know, maybe there is no answer as to whether they're good or bad at this particular point in the story. Maybe it is just that they get in too deep, they get in over their head, they start to behave in ways that we all might, you know. I mean, I'm sure if you asked every person in prison whether they're a bad person or not, they would all say, that wasn't my intention to end up mm-hmm. in prison, or my intention to kind of commit this elaborate crime. I just tried to put out this little spot fire by doing this, and that caused this other spot fire, and I had to try and put that out, which meant that I had to rob Peter to pay Paul, et cetera, and things got out of hand, you know. So I understand and I appreciate the question of whether a character is a sort of a good guy or a bad guy, whether we're mystified by him, et cetera. But for me, obviously, as I say, I'm working from the inside and I'm going, what's his drive? For this character, particularly for Halvorsen in The Innocents, you know, he's very curious about this condition. He's altruistic. He wants to help these women, but he also has an ego. He wants to make a bit of a name for himself. He wants to be the one to discover this, and he wants to do it in such a way where he's not having to deal with the authorities sort of too early on. But he probably should actually be working with a team of people rather than doing this all on his own, you know. So it leads to great drama, and it leads to sort of an unusual sort of situation, and, you know, it was interesting.
And when you played a whole bunch of characters in your career, I guess, do you look, do thematic preoccupations now and again come up naturally, or is this something that you look for? For example, I look at this character and I see elements of this character in Aldrich Killian in Iron Man 3. He's a much less flashy version of that, but you're asking, you said there he's someone who's looking for, he has an ego, but he's also looking for answers, he's looking for the truth, but he wants to be known for this great discovery. Mm. And Peter Weyland, of course, in mm-hmm. Prometheus and Alien Covenant as well.
Well, I'm not looking for it. I mean, and to be honest, if I could, I would make every character that I play be completely different from any other character that I've played, but that's just not possible, you know. There's just not enough out there. Well, there is enough out there, but there's, you know, you've got to be at the top of the A-list to be able to choose absolutely everything you do. And even if you do find things that have similarities, there's really big differences in tone and
of
style
course.
And how mm-hmm. things are written and where a character's from, etc. So, you know, so for me, also from the inside, you know, I feel like I'm playing somebody very different to, you know, and I know I've read things before, and, you know, I'll be halfway through a script and I'll talk to a director, and the director will say, well, I really loved what you did in Memento, and it'd be just great if we could capture that again. And you go, well,
I've done that.
Sure.
Yeah.
But maybe find someone else to do it. And they're like, oh, but, you know, I just love, it'd be great if you could just, like, no. So if you feel like you're clearly going down the road of repetition, you know, it's best to stay away from it. But obviously something like this, yes, I can see the connection between, as you say, Peter Weyland or Killian from Iron Man 3. But there's enough about it that's different, and enough about it that's that feels unique to me on a psychological level and on a personality level that enables me to sort of delve in and you know, and jump on board.
Mm. Accents are interesting to me, but I don't know in terms of an actor's arsenal, what do you consider that to be? Is that an internal thing, or is that something that comes at the very, very end, or is that something that's integral to the whole process of forming a character, deciding how they sound?
Oh, that has to be first for me.
Is that first?
Before anything, yeah. Yeah, if I don't get that, I'm lost.
Okay.
I'm completely lost.
Stop me through Halvorsen.
Well, I mean, sometimes it's not even about an intellectual process. Quite often it's not an intellectual process. It's really what just feels right, what comes out of me when I start reading it, you know. And sometimes I'll be reading something and I might have some conflict within myself about where he should sound like he's from. And often it's not just about accent, but it's about pacing and where the tone of the voice sits and delivery, how articulate they are, and you know, but I feel like once I get a handle on voice, mm-hmm. and voice includes accent, tone, etc., pace, etc., tempo, then I'm off and running. Prior to getting that, I'm just cobbling bits and pieces together. And I go, well, he might walk like this and he might dress like that and he might sort of think this in this situation, but I'm really stuck on where his voice sits. And if I am stuck on that, then because to me, so much is given away. I've got really acute hearing, and so much is given away in somebody's vocal expression. I read so much in people. My eyesight's terrible, so I read much more. I read much more in people in how they sound.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Than anything else. So insecurities. What they're confident about, where they're masking stuff, where they're lying, whether they're, you know, how intelligent or not they are. And look, I can be wrong. I'm not suggesting I'm right about it all, but I feel like I make an assessment about somebody much more through their voice than anything else.
I'm so much more nervous now than I was 2 minutes
ago. Did you dare say anything?
Yeah.
Well, it really, so to the point that it then, it's not like I'm analysing people continually, but we probably all are, well, any more than anybody else might be analysing people, but to the point that's where I feel like I need to land, or I need to kind of swim around in mainly in order to feel like I'm off and running with the character. And sometimes it's obvious, you know, okay, the character's English, he's from London. Okay, well, what sort of London accent do I want to give him? What sort of, and that might be, you know, you might have anything with a director from do what you want guy, we don't care, to we really need him to be from, you know, Arnold Road Bow. You go, okay, let me go to Arnold Road Bow and listen to how people talk from there then.
That sounds so weirdly specific. I think that's a direction you've actually had.
No, it's not, but I lived in Arnold Road Bow once, so I was able to pull that out of my hat.
And do you have a good ear? Can you translate something you hear into, not an impression, that's reductive, but can you say what you hear, essentially?
Yeah, I would say I've got a good ear. I mean, I don't like to brag about anything, but if I was to have a superpower, it would be my my hearing and my ability to pitch something and... yeah, I can tell you if someone's out of tune and how much they're out of tune.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
Okay, bloody hell. I know you're not a performing monkey. I'm not going to ask you to do that now. But that is fascinating to me because I have observed over the years, I'm projecting confidence, so you think I'm intelligent. I have observed over the years, Guy, that Australian actors in particular seem to be really good at accents. They seem to be able to do pretty much anything. I mean, obviously Brits are very good as well, but Australian actors seem to be able to do American, English. Well, that's pretty much it. But there's
it covers two continents.
And of course, Australian as well. Sorry, is there something in the water down there, or is it just...
Well, I think it's interesting because, you know, I mean, you could sort of get into all sorts of things, really. But on some level, I think Australia, historically, and on an evolutionary level, and on a sort of generational level, we have, I don't know if we still do, suffered a bit of an insecurity complex.
Mm-hmm.
We're not Europe and we're not America.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of white Australia was established through convict resettlement. I think, as opposed to America, where people headed off to the promised land, we were sent to Australia because we stole a loaf of bread to feed our family, and we were made to feel like criminals. Mm-hmm. I think that feeds down from generation to generation to generation. We applaud failure in Australia. We don't so much anymore. I think Australia's on the map. We're very proud of ourselves. We really are a country that now kind of goes, hey, we're here now. We've arrived. But I do think that, and it's a gross generalisation, and I'm really not the person to articulate this very well. Yeah. But I do think that that sense of insecurity that we have experienced or we've exhibited over the years has something to say to what you're talking about. And on some level, we as young Australians watch American television and watch English television and watch European films and television, etc., and we aspire to being like these wonderful, you know, countries that seem to offer much more than we do. And we all travel a lot. We come to England and we're told, we go to America and we're told that they're the best in the world. And we try really hard to be really good. And the reality is we've all ended up being pretty good at what we do.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I need to be careful not to be disparaging about America. But I do think that if you keep telling yourself you're the best at something, you've got to be careful because you might miss something along the way. You can be a little blinded to what's actually really going on in the rest of the world. So on some level, I wonder whether our ability to do accents well has got something to do with that.
Yeah.
We're also, you know, we're brought up watching much more American and English and European film and television than we are really watching our own stuff. We obviously Neighbours was huge in the UK, but kind of apart from that, back in the day, there wasn't a lot of Australian stuff that people were watching. And I mean, try to get an American to do an Australian accent. It's, you know, they're not as familiar with it as we are. Yeah. You know, we've been watching American films since they were made. So yeah.
It's really tough. It's a tough accent, the Australian accent.
Australian one, yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it is really tough. And yeah, it's really tough to do it. I mean, look, and I've done lots of accents.
Yours is very good.
Thank you. Thank you for an Englishman. I've done lots of accents in my career, and I know that I've done a lot of them badly. I've done a lot of them where you
really
try really hard and you... Yeah, of course, absolutely. And I might get close, but, you know, you talk to someone who's really from Chicago or really from Boston or really from, you know, Poland, yeah, and you kind of realise how far off you actually are. But I'll still give it a go. You know? I'm still happy to sort of give it a try.
What's the one that's really eluded you? What's the one that either you haven't been able to do at all, or maybe you're in a hotel room late at night, you switch on the TV, there's a Guy Pearce film on, and you go, oh my God,
oh,
no,
no,
turn it
stop
off.
Stop it, turn it off. Yeah. Well, Scottish would be a difficult one, I reckon. I've never done a Scottish accent, and I reckon it's a lot harder than people give it credit for. But some of those East Coast American accents are difficult. That Boston, Chicago stuff's tricky. I've done a Dutch accent twice now. I realise anyone in Holland listening to this would probably spit their tea out and go, what do you mean you've done a Dutch accent twice? You might have attempted it twice. The first time really was, I mean, the director was saying, he'd come up to me every day and he'd go, yeah, you sound Scottish today, or you sound Swedish today, or you sound like you're from South Africa today. So, you know, you can get a general shape, but some accents are just really complicated.
I was revisiting LA Confidential recently, which is a movie I love. I pretty much watch it every year.
Oh, it's great, isn't it?
It's such a great film. And I tweeted that I would like to see you play Ed Exley again and Russell Crowe play Bud White again.
I would love to. And prior to our illustrious director of Curtis Hanson passing away a couple of years ago, we did have conversations about whether or not we might look at doing some sort of sequel. I mean, obviously, you know, there are the books that already exist that Elroy wrote, but there was talk about whether we would do something new, whether we would actually take the story and you know, sort of do 1963, 10 years on from our film. But you know, it never eventuated. But
that's a shame.
Look, and it's difficult, isn't it? Because people often ask me about Priscilla as well, and doing a sequel to that. And as excited as I am at the prospect of something like that, you also go, just think about Grease and the Rocky Horror Show. Careful now.
Yeah.
Do you want to? You know.
Yeah, true.
Just leave it alone. Don't go there.
There's
so
a lot of love for Grease 2 these days. That film has been reevaluated.
It was Michelle Pfeiffer, wasn't it?
It was indeed Michelle Pfeiffer. Yeah.
Okay. I need to go back and look at it again because I need to find the love.
I wanted to ask you specifically about one scene in LA Confidential. And it's after, spoiler alert, it's a movie that was out in 1997. But spoiler alert, after Jack Vincennes is killed, Dudley Smith goes to Ed Exley.
Do you know the name Rollo Tomasi?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And your reaction in that moment tells the audience what we need to know, but doesn't tell Dudley Smith what he needs to know. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, the movie would be a lot shorter. Can you talk about that moment? Can you remember that
moment? I know exactly the moment you mean. Yeah, yeah. And it's in a big close-up. Mm-hmm. And obviously, we see Ed Exley, as you point out, realize that that name is something that only Jack Vincennes knows. And so for Dudley Smith to present that name to Ed, he's just given himself up, essentially. Mm-hmm. And that's the beauty of film to me, is being able to be that intimate with a character where you can really just change your expression in the slightest way, in the most subtle way, and completely and utterly telegraph a piece of information. And I always say to myself these days, I mean, it took me a few years to realize it, what's the least amount I can do at this point in time that gets the point across? Because that has to be the most interesting way to do it.
Yeah.
If you're over the top and you're being too big and you're kind of rolling your eyes and you're doing all the things that are quite often written in scripts.
Rollo Tomasi?
He raises an eyebrow and sweats profusely from his right brow. You know, then quite often that's too much. But to sort of very subtly, you know, have a shift of muscle or whatever it is in your face at a particular moment, yeah, I think can be really telling. So, I know the moment you mean, and, yeah, it's one I like. I'm sure Curtis, you know, directed me to the hilt to get that exact kind of expression.
I'm sick of this. I think you nailed it in one take, and that was lunch. That was it.
Look, working with Curtis Hanson, he really, you know, it was like a serious lesson in film acting.
Fantastic. And Guy Pearce, I'm going to let you go now to watch a double bill, I'm presuming, of The Original Innocence, the 1960s British horror film, and Grease 2. There's a double bill.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Thanks, man. Cheers.
So
while Chris is showing Ian out,
yes.
Helen, what's out this week?
Black Klansman is probably the most exciting one, I think. This is the new film from joint from Spike Lee. It tells the story of Ron Stallworth, played by John Henry Washington, who is a newly recruited black officer in a Colorado police force, who basically calls up the KKK one day and announces that he'd like to join. He then co-opts Adam Driver's flip as his sort of face for the operation, and the two of them basically spy on the Klan.
And you're saying this is more in-depth and better than the prologue to Bad Boys 2?
Yes, it is. It's a very, very good film. It's a weird tonal film because it shifts between moments of real comedy and moments of just like gut-dropping horror, you know, because you're watching these incredible, awful racists do their thing for quite a lot of the film. But, you know, fantastic, fantastic performances. We should also mention Laura Harrier, who's in, of course, Spider-Man Homecoming, is really, really good here. She kind of provides a bit of balance to the film. She's Patrice, who's a young black activist, and she basically presents the other side and I think highlights a little bit the uneasiness of Stallworth's position as a member of an institutionally racist police force, but someone who's, you know, trying to undermine an institution of racism in the KKK. But he's also drawn to her and he's drawn to her cause, and he's sort of caught in the middle. And he has also, you know, the first operation that the police send him on is to spy on black activists. So it's not a clear-cut case where he is the good guy, you know, fighting the good fight against racism. It's not quite that simplistic. It's a quite a nuanced thing. Having said that, this is still a Spike Lee film, and we don't really, and I don't mean this disrespectfully, we don't really look to him for nuance so much as we look to him for passion and for anger and for polemic. And I think he's the great polemicist of our times, and this is no exception. This is a film that really, really hits you. Particularly when you get to the end and they highlight some of the already obvious parallels between those times and our own time. So this is, I think, one of his best films in a little while. He's obviously incredibly prolific. Not everyone is a hit, but his hit rate is still pretty damn high.
And we gave this one 4 stars.
Hurrah.
And what else is out this week?
Also out this week is The Children Act.
Yes, which Emma Thompson.
Emma Thompson plays a British judge. She is married to Stanley Tucci. Which is a position we'd all like to be in, I'm sure. And
he wrote a cookbook. Did you know this?
I did know this. He's a heck of a cook. But they're going through a little bit of marital difficulties. And meanwhile, she is called upon to try a very difficult case, which is the case of a young Jehovah's Witness who is extremely ill and needs blood transfusion as part of his treatment. Of course, that goes against his religion. But he's underage. So his parents don't want him to have it. He doesn't want to have it. But he is underage, so he doesn't have necessarily the last word. The court does. And she essentially has to make the decision of the court. So she actually goes and talks to this young man. And they form a strange sort of bond. And that kind of brings into relief what's up in her life, and also what she should do for him or not do. It's an interesting kind of character study more than a moral dilemma, I think. But she's fantastic. Fantastic performances all round. I didn't love the ending personally, and I feel like that might just be the book, which I haven't read, but I don't think. I think it all comes from the book. But really, really good character piece. Fantastic performance from Emma Thompson. And actually a very rare, realistic feeling depiction of the legal profession, which was quite exciting for me as a former lawyer.
And we gave that one 3 stars.
That seems about right to me.
I fully agree with everything you just said.
You've definitely been
here
for it.
For the last 5 minutes. And I can only add +1 to everything you've just said.
So, 4 stars now.
4 stars then for the
Children Act.
The Children Act! Yeah, why not? Why not?
Yeah, we're just throwing stars around. Okay. As opposed to Helen, who tends to take stars away from things.
And since we give Black Townsman 4, I'm in a +1 kind of mood. Let's give it a 5.
That's not how this works.
That's how it works.
Can we do Molly's game while we're at it?
No!
I want to mention very, very briefly, because we are in such a rush, that there is a really great documentary about Elvis out this week. Elvis Presley, not Elvis Costello, directed by Eugene Jarecki. It's called The King. Well, of course it is. But it's about so much more than Elvis. It's about fire alarms and America and culture and the 20th century and all those great big concepts. But it's also about the king of rock and roll as well. So if you're a big Elvis fan, as indeed I am, then go and check out The King.
Also out this week, The Spy Who Dumped Me, which stars Mila Kunis and Kate McKinnon, who apparently both do sterling work. I haven't seen it, but we gave it 3 stars.
This is the best review section of the show, I think, in the history. So I wasn't here for the first 2 films. Then I come in and I go, hey, you should watch this film, it's pretty good. And then you go, I haven't seen Spy Who Dumped Me, but we gave it 3 stars.
We are consummate professionals.
2 stars?
We gave it 3.
3 stars.
3 whole stars, so 4 now.
I wasn't even listening to what you were saying, so we're all good. We're all good. All right. We do have to run, sadly. We are being tapped in the window and people are trying to drag us out of here. So that is it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week. Oh, I should probably be mentioned as well that if you want to come and see us live.
Yes.
September 7th, Friday, September 7th from 7 o'clock at the London Podcast Festival. I think tickets are still on sale. Go to the website www.kingsplace.co.uk to check that out. There is also a new podcast out for you to listen to, which we discuss the 50 greatest Star Wars characters of all time, which is a tie-in podcast with our current cover feature. The new issue of Empire, of course, is on sale right now, All Good and Evil News Agents, so do pick that up. And there will be an episode of The Ranking up at some point next week as well. Finally, now I've got some spare time, I can get around to getting one of those things, one of those bad boys up on the old pod web. So come and see us, and I don't think we're revealing the guests just yet, but do come along and see us. That should be a lot of fun as well.
And bring gifts.
Bring lots of gifts. We'll bring you gifts as well. We should probably get sorted them, getting some spot prizes for people.
I think people should bring me spot prizes.
You think?
That's not how this works.
It should be.
Bring us cash and food and spot prizes. And if you're coming over from Northern Ireland, which I know someone is, someone got in touch and said they're flying over from Belfast for the live pod, prepare for disappointment, but also bring us feta bread. That's all I ask. I don't ask for much.
I don't even like feta bread.
Club Orange, feta bread. And you know what? Peace and hope in our hearts.
Oh, that's lovely. I'll take some of that.
Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by lots of cool people. Chloe Grace Moretz will be on the podcast. Barry Keoghan and the director Bart Layton will be on the podcast to talk about their film American Animals as well. All right. Until that auspicious occasion, we should also thank Ian Morris for being a phenomenal guest today. And I should probably thank James Dyer.
Thanks, Chris.
And Helen O'Hara.
Cheerio.
I mean, I should thank you, but I'm not sure if I will.
You won't, of course.
I won't thank you. Fine. I mean, that would be weird. And it is goodbye from me. I've got that all wrong. I've completely forgotten how to finish this podcast. Right, it's goodbye from James.
Bye.
It's goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to bump up my HQ bank account once more. This is my idea. This is my thing, okay? If I win 100 more at £8 a pop,
mm-hmm.
mini holiday. And you guys,
wow.
you guys.
Only 100 to go, huh?
Helen, yep. James, believe me when I say, you guys are going to be hosting the podcast while I'm away. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.